Hello and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the emergence of fascist politics in the United States under President Trump and get an analysis of why in countries around the world, such as Hungary, Poland, Russia, India, Italy, and Turkey, fascist leaders are exploiting myths, grudges, propaganda, anti-intellectualism, and prejudice against minorities to divide us from them while trampling on democratic ideals and institutions. Jason Stanley, professor of philosophy at Yale University and author of How Propaganda Works, joins us to discuss his new book just out, How Fascism Works, The Politics of Us and Them. We'll examine how and why, 75 years after the Allies triumphed over fascism, it is on the rise again, and get an understanding of the 10 pillars of fascist politics and how fascist roots have been present in the United States for more than a century, only to be revived and normalized by our current leader. With the United States at the crossroads between democracy and authoritarianism, Jason Stanley reveals how the liberties of people wither and democracies die when voters embrace politicians who promote the divisive politics of us versus them. Then we'll continue the conversation and speak with Adele Stan, a journalist based in Washington, D.C., who specializes in covering the intersection of religion and politics. She is the editor of Right Wing Watch and a weekly columnist for The American Prospect, where she has an article, Trump and the Rise of 21st Century Fascism. And we will discuss how Trump is a neo-fascist only because he is constrained by our Constitution. But with a derelict Republican legislative branch, a new Supreme Court, and a new Attorney General to do his bidding, an unfettered Trump could become a full-blown fascist. Then finally, we'll speak with Jeff Biggers, an award-winning historian, journalist, and playwright, whose latest book is Resistance, Reclaiming an American Tradition, which reframes today's political battles as a continuum of a vibrant American tradition. He joins us to lay out a case for resistance in the age of Trump using Thomas Paine's Common Sense, which was the spark that lit the American Revolution to overthrow the rule of a mad British king, as a narrative for the current resistance to overthrow our dangerous and delusional president. And joining us now is Jason Stanley, a professor of philosophy at Yale and author of Know-How, Languages in Context, Knowledge and Practical Interests, and How Propaganda Works. His latest book just out is How Fascism Works, The Politics of Us and Them. Welcome to Background Briefing, Jason Stanley.
Thank you, Ian.
And it seems that the F word, you know, which is bandied about a lot, particularly people on the left sometimes use it rather loosely and perhaps even irresponsibly. But I think now that we're deeply immersed in the Trump regime, it's obvious his behavior is more of a mob boss than a president of the United States. The fact that he, for example, rails against the Attorney General on the basis that the Attorney General, Jeff Sessions, didn't protect him from the law, but is rather doing his job of upholding the law, I think says a lot about this man's mindset. He's not even embarrassed about making the point that he thinks the job of the Attorney General is to protect him from the law, not to uphold the laws and the Constitution of the United States. So it's pretty evident, isn't it, that I don't know where you would rank Donald Trump on the scale of fascist despots, whether between, say, a wannabe and a full-blown fascist. But he seems to be certainly on that path. And I'm told by sources in the Pentagon that they're afraid that as Mueller closes in on him, he's going to order the bombs to drop somewhere. So I think we're in for a rough ride.
So fascism, my book is in the first instance, How Fascism Works is in the first instance about fascist tactics. And people can judge for themselves about the degree to which they find these tactics present around them or present in the current day United States. But take your point about mob bosses. This is something we find squarely in the description of fascist politicians. Hannah Arendt repeatedly connects fascism to the mafia. She says fascist leaders are like mob bosses. You know, the point of, for example, fascism, like any form of authoritarianism, prizes loyalty. And since it's fascism, it's loyalty to the leader who represents the nation. So loyalty to the leader is the principal value of fascist ideology. And it's the principal value of mafia, of the mafia as well. So these parallels, they are familiar. They're in the literature on fascism. When you find a leader repeatedly bearing down on loyalty as the primary principle, loyalty to the nation, loyalty to him, loyalty to race, loyalty to tradition, rather than the truth, rather than justice, then, you know, we're looking at what history regards as one symptom of fascist ideology.
Well, he does, President Trump certainly seems to have ties, at least in terms of money laundering, to Russian mobsters, and before that, his father, to Italian mobsters. And Roy Cohn, of course, who represented the two big mafia crime families in New York, it was Trump's mentor. But going back to Hitler, for example, and the Nazi movement, it began with basically street thugs, the Erich Röhm, the SA. And I think that was one of the reasons why at Munich, Chamberlain simply didn't understand who he was dealing with. He thought, because he came out of the tradition of gentlemanly diplomacy, and he basically thought he was dealing with a gentleman, and he didn't realize he was dealing with a gangster.
Yeah, because it's all about winning for the in fascist ideology. Your loyalty is just to the leader, to yourself, to your fellow mobsters, essentially, and you know, it's just the sort of veneer. Nationalism is a veneer around this. Sure, you can add, okay, the loyalty is to the race, so we can do anything to those who are not in the race or who don't share our ethnic background, but there's no notion of fairness in fascist ideology. So when you find people, you know, not respecting any rules, not respecting any notion of fairness or equal respect, well, that's a symptom. It doesn't mean what you have is full-blown fascism, but, you know, the code of loyalty of the mafia and the code of loyalty of fascist ideology are going to look awfully similar, because what you have is just fierce, uncompromising, fanatical loyalty to a leader based around identification with race or family, and then nothing else matters because all the rest is sort of liberal claptrap.
Let's talk a little bit about the DNA of fascism in the American body politic, particularly going back to the time of in the 30s with the rise of the fascists in Europe and particularly in Italy and in Germany. There are an awful lot of American plutocrats who are quite sympathetic to the fascists. A lot of attention, of course, is paid to Charles Lindbergh, but Henry Ford, the DuPonts, George W. Bush's grandfather, the Koch brothers' father, Fred Koch, he went to Nazi Germany and built for them a oil refinery that refined aviation gasoline, without which the Luftwaffe wouldn't have gotten off the ground. So isn't there a strain in America? I don't know that it's so much at the grassroots level, but it certainly seems to be there amongst the elite.
It's there on the grassroots level. As the KKK has strong in the 1920s, which is both an elite and a grassroots white movement, is strongly influences and connected and is connected to European fascism. I mean, Will Rogers, the famous actor and newspaper columnist from the first part of the 20th century, in a 1933 column writes, "Papers all state Hitler is trying to copy Mussolini. Looks to me it's the KKK that he's copying. He don't want to be emperor. He wants to be Kliegel." So it was seen at the time that the KKK in the United States and Hitler were connected. In my book, I clearly document the connection between the Nazi ideology and, for example, the union-busting ideology of Vance Muse, the person who came up with right-to-work laws, who first pushed right-to-work laws in Texas. So in both cases, what you find are hysterical conspiracy theories of Jewish-led unions which are promoting Marxism and spreading the doctrine of racial equality to poison the minds of black Americans so that they think they're equal to whites. So you find the same attacks on unions in Mein Kampf as you do in the history of, say, the right to work movement legislation, which is covered in the book. The fundamental KKK ideology looks a lot like National Socialism. The idea is that Jews are promoting Marxism and labor unions and Marxism and liberalism to get black Americans to engage in a race war and then the Jews can take over. Well, this is the idea of Jews as a global conspiracy aiming to overthrow the white race. So it's as my colleague Jim Whitman points out in his book, Hitler's American Model, the Nuremberg laws are based explicitly on the U.S. anti-miscegenation laws. So in fascist movements are always about purity. So recently Tucker Carlson said he didn't like illegal immigrants because he doesn't like litter. So this idea of purity, that foreigners are dirty, is sort of a fascist motif. And what you find in fascist politics is repeated panic about rape threats or intermarriage between foreigners and the chosen people, women of the nation. So you have this this theme. So the laws governing marriage that the Nazis instituted in Nuremberg, Jews were one-eighth. Anyone who was one-eighth Jewish or more by hereditary was Jewish and could not marry a non-Jew. They were based explicitly on the U.S. Racial laws. So it's hard to distinguish our history of white supremacy from the history of European fascism.
So you write about the sort of 10 pillars of fascism. Fascism, of course, demands patriarchy. Yeah. It's also Orwellian. It markets corruption as anti-corruption, irrationality as reason, and suppression as freedom of speech. It's anti-intellectual, anti-education, substituting unreality for intelligent observation. It favors hierarchy, racism, and union busting, as you've just pointed out. It adopts a passionate stance in terms of victimhood. Remember at Charlottesville, they were shouting, "The Jews will not replace us."
Right.
Then, of course, it demands so-called law and order, but it's usually the inverse of that. And then it fears, or stokes fears of sex and rape. Donald Trump, of course, in his opening salvo, when he announced his run for the presidency, talked about Mexicans as rapists. But there was a piece recently by Paul Krugman where he starts out by saying, "After the Berlin Wall, a friend of mine, an expert on international relations, made a joke. Now that Eastern Europe is free from the alien ideology of communism, it can return to its true historical path, fascism." And that certainly seems to be happening in Hungary and Poland. So what's your understanding of why that, what we thought was an extinguished ideology, has had a revival?
Well, I don't think in any of these countries it was ever extinguished. I think that you can't, as Krugman also points out, you can't pin Poland's collapse into fascism on economic anxiety, because Poland was booming. Poland was doing incredibly well. It's just that the desire to view your group as superior, the desire to view your national past as somehow glorious, is for some reason extremely tempting to people. It's valorizing. It makes people feel noble and better, and then you can represent encroaching globalism and cosmopolitanism as fundamental threats. People are very susceptible to view the other as terrifying. In Poland and Hungary, there's very, very few refugees or immigrants, and yet there's a full-on panic about refugees and immigrants. We see Germany itself, the home of the Nazi Party. We had thousands of pro-Nazi demonstrators on the streets of Chemnitz the other day after the murder of a German by two immigrants. So we find this, we find these sentiments are a tinderbox. I mean, humans are very likely, are somehow very inclined to the ideology I describe in my book. And we see it, it's not just local to Europe or the United States. India, the Hindu nationalists, there too we find panic about Muslim rapists. We find riots caused by suspected rapes of Hindu women by Muslims. You know, Hindu nationalism has taken over India in the literal sense. The government is run by Hindu nationalists. So I think, you know, what I do in my book is I argue, I'm really arguing that fascism is always there. It's always a threat. What we should be surprised about is democracy.
You mean democracy is an aberration?
Democracy is an aberration.
So as such, then, it has to be energetically defended.
Energetically defended. We cannot think it can't happen here because, you know, if you look at human history, democracy, liberal democracy, is the incredible exception. Now, fascism is just one kind of authoritarianism. There's monarchy, there's certain kind of communist dictatorships. Fascism is an ultra-nationalist, anti-cosmopolitan, patriarchal, mythical, fear-based, militaristic, and macho version of authoritarianism. So it's a very particular form, and it's an interesting question why we're facing worldwide right now a rise in that form of authoritarianism, but we are.
And, of course, when you talk about myth, Donald Trump's motto, of course, is right in that tradition, make America great again.
Absolutely. So the first chapter of my book is called The Mythic Path. All fascist movements begin by creating nostalgia for a past that never was. And the past always looks the same. In that past, the heroic men were great warriors. The women stayed at home and raised the next generation. The men of the chosen nation ruled benevolently over the despised minorities who knew their place. And, you know, if you look at that mythic past, it looks a lot like what Southerners think of the Confederacy.
Well, we have, you know, a real example, I think, of, I mean, I don't know how to distinguish the Know-Nothing movement of 100 years ago with the rise of fascism and the extent to which the Republican Party is accommodating it, because the Republican Party is becoming more and more like an American version of the ruling parties in Poland and Hungary.
Absolutely, with strong links to those parties.
Right, and the way that they don't think about the loyal opposition, or they just want to extinguish the Democrats. They
right, so in
take
Hannah
their
Arendt,
money, you know, the loyal.
Right, Hannah Arendt talks about the final stage before full fascism as government. She calls it party over parties. And what she means by party over parties is one party rule. She says there comes a point where people feel the temptation for loyalty to their political party over a multi-party system. That's what she means by party over parties. Loyalty to the political party over loyalty to a multi-party system. And we are clearly at that stage where the Republican members of the Republican Party, prominent members of the Republican Party, feel it's within their grasp. They are more loyal to the Republican Party than they are to the concept of democracy, to the concept of a multi-party system. So we are already there, and we're beginning to see the next stage, and where the next stage is the party becomes subsumed and becomes merely a vehicle for the leader. So we are already seeing people say, well, look, the Republican Party isn't a party anymore. It's just about allegiance to Donald Trump. And that is the next stage. But we are already at the point where we see explicitly the desire for loyalty to party over the very idea of a multi-party system. We have major, major Republican candidates, some of the worst of which are Kris Kobach in Kansas, Brian Kemp in Georgia, who are explicitly running on the basis of of their success in advancing anti-democratic goals. Kris Kobach, his entire political life has been devoted to a conspiracy theory about as wild as the protocols of the Elders of Zion about immigrants illegally voting. Absolutely no evidence for it. He's devoted his life for it, and on that basis, he's won the he's the Republican candidate to be governor of Kansas. Brian Kemp, his political life, his political success is due entirely to his record. The New York Times calls it as a master of voter suppression. So these are explicitly anti-democratic candidates. So one thing people said a year ago when I would talk about fascism is they said, oh, it's not fascism because fascists are explicitly anti-democratic. But now we have two clearly anti-democratic movements. First, we see clearly that the vast majority of the Republican Party is taken over by a clear ideology of party over parties, more loyalty to Republicans than to the idea of a multi-party system. And two, we're seeing major candidates for office whose sole credential for office is their success at tearing down democracy.
Well, Jason Stanley, I appreciate you joining us here today on this Labor Day weekend, and I hope we talk again soon.
Thank you, Ian.
And again, I've been speaking with Jason Stanley. He's a professor of philosophy at Yale University and author of How Propaganda Works. His latest book just out is How Fascism Works, The Politics of Us and Them. We're going to take a brief station break and back looking into how Trump, unconstrained, would be a full-blown fascist.
Well, I'm going to tell you, fascists, you may be surprised. People in this world are getting organized. You're bound to lose. You fascists bound to lose.
Woo! All you fascists bound to lose.
I said,
all you fascists bound to lose.
Yes.
All you fascists bound to lose. You're bound to lose. You fascists bound to lose.
For love of glory never seen.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now is Adele Stan, a journalist based in Washington, D.C., who specializes in covering the intersection of religion and politics. She is currently the editor of Right Wing Watch, a weekly columnist for The American Prospect, and a contributor to Sirius XM Progress. And her latest article at The American Prospect is Trump and the Rise of 21st Century Fascism. Welcome to Background Briefing, Adele Stan.
Always great to be with you, Ian.
Well, thank you, Adele. And your article, I think, makes a very, very important case, and that is that Donald Trump is a neo-Nazi, but if he's able to get away with the unconstitutional activity that is going on now, has been since he was elected, and is likely to increase in terms of his authority, if a Kavanaugh gets on the court, Kavanaugh's already said that presidents should get more power. Well, God, giving this guy more power, that ought to wake people up. And it looks as though he's going to, we know from a few days ago that he's going to fire Don McGahn, his counsel. Mm-hmm. He's definitely going to fire Sessions.
It really looks that way, doesn't it?
Yeah, the minute he can, probably either before or certainly after the elections. And then that will enable him, through the Vacancy Act, to get rid of Rosenstein and to shut down Mueller. And the real key then will be, and this will be America's come-to-Jesus moment, will the Republicans rise up or will they just accept it? And I suspect the latter will be true.
I agree with you. I mean, this is what I think is even more frightening to me, Ian, than the rise of Donald Trump, is the willingness of the Republican Party to have this neo-fascist as their standard bearer and to allow him to to usurp all of this power, including theirs, right? Including theirs, by not being any kind of a check on him, by using their position as the majority party, not, to thwart any kind of investigation, to create obstacles for the investigators by, demanding ridiculous requests for documentation that is part of an active criminal investigation, which, of course, they're not going to get that. All that kind of stuff. I mean, this Republican Party is really very happy to be brought to its knees by this guy because it's all about power.
Well, I can understand from their point of view that they don't want to, just before the election, say, oh, oops, we made a mistake. The leader of our party is a kleptocrat and a criminal who is controlled by a hostile foreign power. That's a hard thing for the American people to get their heads around. So I'm not excusing the Republicans.
No, but there's a space between getting rid of and keeping a check on him, right?
Well, that's what the Constitution says, that the legislative branch is in a check and balance on the executive branch.
Exactly.
That's American as apple pie in the U.S. Constitution.
Right, and their refusal to take up that role in any, whether it's the deregulation of the EPA or whether it's, whatever it is. There's no check on him whatsoever, none whatsoever. And then their willingness to in the case of, say, Devin Nunes on the the House Intelligence Committee, or Chuck Grassley in the Senate Intelligence Committee, to create all kinds of obstacles to people who are actually, who have been appointed to do an investigation of the president. Right?
Right.
So. Yeah.
Well, Grassley's the Judiciary Committee, but the other guy, Burr.
Oh, my bad.
Yeah,
sorry.
Burr is on the Intelligence Committee.
He's been
reasonable, and
he is more reasonable. Grassley, though,
he's
in his capacity as the Judiciary Committee chairman, has been an obstructionist as well.
Of course. And preceding you, Adele, on today's program on this Labor Day weekend, I was talking with Jason Stanley, the philosopher at Yale, whose new book is How Fascism Works, The Politics of Us and Them. And it's an extraordinarily deep dive into the history of fascism and how it relates to the current situation here in the United States. And he identifies 10 pillars of fascist politics and charts their horrifying rise and deep history. So let's go to our neo-Nazi leader. He's not yet Mussolini or Adolf Hitler, but I think he's shown some distinct signs of that he basically believes in a fascist ideology and is incredibly sympathetic to far right wing nutcases in this country, mm-hmm. really dangerous, marginal people like Alex Jones. Last week, he ranted at 5:30 in the morning. He tweeted out an attack on Google. And most of the coverage on that got it wrong, because if you actually listen to what he said later in a photo op when he was ranting about Google, he was talking about how they're upsetting a whole bunch of people in this country, and what Facebook and Google and Twitter are doing is really bad, and it's upsetting a lot of people, and basically threatened to come after them. Well, he's carrying Alex Jones's water. It's all about Alex Jones being shut
down. Absolutely.
And I cannot for the life of me understand why people in the press didn't notice that that's what he was talking about. It's not just the algorithms in Google that he's complaining about. That's something he learned from some stupid right-wing article he read. But he really made a stand in support of Alex Jones, who is being shut down by Google and Facebook, YouTube, and Twitter.
Right. And that is he's doing two things, right? This whole meme on the right of ostensibly being censured. First of all, what they did was they people like Alex Jones and others who have been other far right figures who have been banned from various platforms. They're banned because they violated the terms of service of these companies. In fact, my colleague Jared Holt here at Right Wing Watch was the guy who noticed that Jones was still being hosted by Spotify and looked at their terms of service. And saw Jones in direct violation of them and made that an issue. And so you have it operating on two levels. Yes, you do have Trump supporting Jones, without a doubt, and that is where this whole meme, you know, this theme of, oh my gosh, the tech companies are all censoring conservative thought. Well, I mean, if crazy racist conspiracy theory is conservative thought, well, first of all, I don't know. The old school conservatives would not have wanted to quite own that. But aside from that, so you have it to be Jones's personal crusade or creed de coeur, whatever you want to call it, and then you have the sort of the ideology behind what Jones is saying about his banning by all of these different entities. And of course, he's a purveyor of fake news, and so this is another way of saying, don't believe what you see. Don't believe, you know, who are you going to believe, me or your lying eyes? You know. So it's operating on two levels, but you're right. And I'm not surprised the mainstream media missed it, though, Ian, that they're not as sharp as you. Because they're still grappling with the reality that at the heart of power in Washington, D.C. are these white nationalists, neo-fascists, right supremacists, that they're in the White House. I mean, just last week, Larry Kudlow, a Wall Street guy who is now chairing the Council of Economic Advisors, was found to have invited one of Richard Spencer's best pals, Peter Brimelow, to his birthday party. You know what I mean? It's like, no, this is not like, these are not just like fringe hangers-on of this administration. This administration is deeply entwined with these movements.
Well, there are good people on both sides, you know.
Very fine people.
Right.
Very fine people.
Right. And they have those very sharp uniforms, the nice brown ones and the black ones.
Well, I mean, that's where it gets really dicey, right? Because you do have, you know, the rank and file of these movements, of these far-right movements, whether they be, you know, neo-Nazi, neo-pagans, or far-right neo-Confederate Christians. You know, they have rank and file, often comprising, you know, rather unhinged people. So the leader can make a claim and the follower goes and does something crazy, just as the guy who drove the car into the crowd of protesters in Charlottesville did. I mean, so that's where the brown shirt aspect, you know, comes in. I mean, these guys who look like a bunch of cosplayers, you know, with their homemade, you know, plywood shields and Confederate flags can become, you know, a brown shirt type force.
Well, Jones, of course, makes up the craziest stuff, and Trump apparently believes it.
Right.
But a better example, I think, is Trump making this tweet in support of the alleged victimization of white farmers in South Africa and how they're being murdered by blacks. It's just simply not happening. Land reform is happening, but not the murder of white farmers. And so Trump tweets out in support of something that's not real. I don't think there's any other way to interpret it. That's where his sympathies lie. I mean, do you see any other reason? I mean, is the neo-Nazi base in this country so important that he has to cultivate it?
Well, what it is that it's not that you have a strong plurality of Americans who would identify as neo-Nazi or neo-Confederate, but you do have a strong plurality of white Americans who harbor very racist views and anti-immigrant views, which are, of course, really rooted in race, and misogynist views, which are really rooted in, the whole white patriarchy kind of construct that you find in evangelical circles and other places. So So what you will have is it looks like a tiny, you know, remnant fringe, you know, left over from, you know, World War II and the Civil War. But they are expressing things that more polite people believe but won't say and who are sympathetic to. So, and these far-right folks have very effective social media networks, and the memes and themes that they push and on social media do get picked up elsewhere in the political sphere. And that's why there is such consternation right now. It's not simply that Jones is, you know, losing some of his reach, which affects the monetization of his business, but it's also that those, you know, those tropes have to take different avenues in order to be expressed. Now, with Tucker Carlson advancing this trope that rose up from the far right in both South Africa and in the U.S. And, you know, as soon as he said it, the alt-right, we have a post up on Right Wing Watch that shows this. You know, the alt-right just was delighted. You know, they were all over Twitter, or those who have been kicked off Twitter and are on their own form of Twitter called Gab. You know, they were all just, you know, they were just lighting up. They were so thrilled. And then when Trump picked it up, oh, my goodness, you know, he's speaking truth. You know, that's all they needed to hear.
So with Right Wing Watch, is there any way that you can get the message to shame Trump supporters? Because I think, first of all, the median income of Trump supporters was something like $70,000. And the Democrats fretting over the loss of the white working class is a waste of time.
Yeah, no, that's not who the problem is.
Exactly. So how do you get to those people with 401ks that basically they just think the liberals and the progressives are all in a lather over nothing, and they think it's all political. They think mm-hmm. that the Democrats are trying to steal Trump's victory through using Mueller, and they are completely tuned out of anything that's going on that people on MSNBC are glued to. And they basically think that, you know, he's doing a great job because the 401ks and the stock markets had an uninterrupted bull market for 3,500 days in a row. So how do you fight that reality? How do you prick that bubble?
Well, I don't know that there's any way to convince those people otherwise until their fortunes fail. I think the game is an electoral game at the moment, primarily, and it's based around turnout. Because here's the thing, if the Democrats can keep their coalition together, right, and that's always the challenge for Democrats. They you know, it's not a homogenous constituency in the way that the Republican Party is. It's multiracial, it's multicultural, all of that. But if the Dems keep their, if they can keep their coalition together, which is easier when you're in opposition to a force such as Trump, but really amp up the turnout, the voter turnout game. I mean, that what you see in Florida with the election of with the primary election of Andrew Gillum, right? I mean, he was not projected to win. That was because a lot of people turned up to vote who, you know, had not been voting in primaries. So they weren't likely voters.
Right, but just a minor correction. There was a greater Republican turnout than a Democrat turnout in both.
There was.
In both Florida and Arizona last week.
Yes, in these primary elections. But the Democrats, I'm not saying that there was, you know, more Democrats than Republicans. What I'm saying is the Democrats vastly upped their own turnout than, compared to previous primary elections. And it's always hard to engage people in primaries, especially if you haven't been working at it for, you know, a generation, which I don't think the Democrats really have been. I think that the coalition represented by Democrats is a greater proportion of the country than the constituency represented by Trump, but they need to turn out. Now, we still have a structural and constitutional problem, Ian, that I don't know how we fix, and that's the Electoral College when you get to the presidential race. You know,
sure. But well, that's another a conversation for another day.
For another day.
Right. But I thank you for joining us on this Labor Day weekend, and I appreciate the conversation, Adele.
It's always great to be with you. I hope you get a day of rest. And I'd love folks to follow me on Twitter, at Addie Stan.
And again, I've been speaking with Adele Stan, who is a journalist based in Washington, D.C., who specializes in covering the intersection of religion and politics. She's currently the editor of Right Wing Watch, a weekly columnist for The American Prospect and a contributor to SiriusXM Progress. And her latest article at The American Prospect is Trump and the Rise of 21st Century Fascism. We're going to take a brief station break and we'll be back looking into the resistance and its roots in the American Revolution. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now on this Labor Day weekend is Jeff Biggers, an award-winning historian, journalist, and playwright. He's the author of several books, including The United States of Appalachia, State Out of the Union, and Reckoning at Eagle Creek, and The Trials of a Scold, the founder of the Climate Narrative Project. His latest book is Resistance, Reclaiming an American Tradition. Welcome to Background Briefing, Jeff Biggers.
Thanks for having me back, Ian.
And tomorrow, Labor Day, is the beginning of the political season. There's an expectation, that, for example, that the special prosecutor, Robert Mueller, will go silent during this period. I don't know whether that will happen or not. But if the resistance doesn't get its act together and make this blue wave happen, we will have more of Trump. And frankly, we don't know exactly the extent to which the Russians are going to meddle in the elections to help Trump again, as they did in 2016. So here we are, I guess, on the cusp of what has to be a couple of months of serious, sustained resistance.
You know, I think you're precisely right, Ian, and I think it's always been that way. Part of my work is to say, you know, we've gone through these dark periods before in history. And so if we look at the not just sort of random episodes, but the continuum of resistance, you know, I think what I'm saying is, how can we learn from that to apply it today? I think precisely what you're saying is true, is that we need to really look at the resistance as giving a backbone now, both to the Democratic Party, but to other means of taking on this administration, both now and with the midterm elections.
But there was a spontaneous manifestation of resistance the day after Trump's inauguration, where millions of women and men as well, but mostly women from around the country and around the world, spontaneously demonstrated. So that was literally right out of the gate, but it wasn't sustained, and it's not sustaining. And here on the, you know, last week we had the 50th anniversary of the Chicago riots at the Democratic Convention. One of the questions I asked the former head of security for the Students for a Democratic Society was, you know, what happened to the anti-war movement that was so powerful? The minute that Nixon ended the Vietnam War, it sort of evaporated. It wasn't a sustained movement. So that is one of the things that I detect about the political left in this country. The movements don't tend to be very sustaining. How do you see it?
Well, it's really one of the reasons why I wrote my book on resistance, and I really looked at it as something beyond just protest or electoral politics, but a deeper cultural tradition, but also sort of a deeper cultural duty. You know, Ian, I go back before the American Revolution and look at sort of what were the challenges of the day that made people come together and begin to seed a credo that whenever we have duplicitous attacks, you know, on our democracy, on our inalienable rights, our civil rights, how do we come together to confront that? And I kind of walk us through both indigenous movements and American Revolution up till today to see how resistance really is part of a long-term, what we call long-haul approach in our American culture, that we have this fundamental American credo to resist whenever you have this kind of authoritarian spasms and overreach of our rights. And so I think you're right, and part of what I wanted to do as a cultural historian is write a book that kind of rooted the resistance, and especially within the last year or two, and to show that everything that we're fighting against today, we have been fighting for many decades, if not centuries, and that it's part of a long continuum and a long battle, and part of kind of remaining resilient and being sustainable in these kind of movements is to once again realize that we're on the shoulders of many other movements in the past and to not lose hope.
Well, the United States since the Revolution, and of course your book basically lays out a case for the resistance in the age of Trump using the clarion call of the American Revolution, Thomas Paine's Common Sense. But just to add some context before we get into the history that you're relating to the revolution to the current resistance, the United States has never had a president who is a criminal who is possibly controlled by a hostile foreign power. So, I mean, this is not like it. I would say this is a different moment in terms of what we're up against.
Yeah, in that situation, I think you're perfectly right. I think also we've never had an administration in a time of climate change, which we have such irreparable damage happening to our environment. And so I think certainly there are some unique moments right now. But if we look at the past, we can see other moments which were equally as bleak and dark. For example, if we look at the 1790s when John Adams became president, now, here's someone who often is considered, you know, the great abolitionist and one of the great forefathers of our nation, and also one of the main players in our American Revolution. But we forget that once he took power, you know, he had an incredible grasp, a stranglehold, and in fact, insisted being called His Highness and pushed through the Alien Act, which gave him the power to deport anyone he found dangerous, and got the right to the Sedition Act in 1798. Which forbade anyone to print, write, or say anything against the president or the U.S. Congress, and a complete shutdown of our First Amendment rights. And so, you know, through history, we have gone through these little dark episodes where you have a president who completely has attempted to have a stranglehold on power, be it, you know, orchestrated from an outside foreign source, like we have today, perhaps, to and internally with, you know, our own kind of aristocracy. From the beginnings of our country.
Well, I stand corrected then, Jeff Biggers. President Adams, Donald Trump would want to be like President Adams. He would want to be able to shut down all dissent. Last week he went after Google based upon some lunatic right-wing conspiracy theory. He's fighting algorithms. I often say he's like King Canute fighting the tide, since truth presumably eventually prevails. So, no, obviously we have indeed been through more imperious examples in terms of the presidency, and we're certainly up against it at the moment. And again, I'm speaking on this Labor Day weekend with Jeff Biggers, who's an award-winning historian, journalist, and playwright. He's the author of several books, including The United States of Appalachia, State Out of the Union, and Reckoning at Eagle Creek, and The Trials of a Scald, the founder of the Climate Narrative Project. His latest book is Resistance, Reclaiming an American Tradition. So let's go back to the American Revolution and how you feel that the Thomas Paine in particular, his famous tract Common Sense, lays the foundation for resistance in the age of Trump.
Sure. You know, Paine, you know, here he comes across the seas in a very late period in 1775, and what I refer to as an undocumented immigrant, someone who barely is managed to get on the boat. He's actually sick in his passage. He arrives in Philadelphia on a stretcher because he's so sick. And basically, here's someone who Trump today would consider, you know, someone he'd want to block from immigration, someone who twice had been in debt and been an economic disaster in his own country, had gone through two failed marriages, and who couldn't even make it as a tax collector in England. But Paine wanted to come to our country because of this, you know, burgeoning resistance movement, this independence movement. And when he gets there in Philadelphia in 1775, he's kind of outraged because there's this young movement that's trying to buck the system, these young dock workers, people largely who are African-Americans and natives and Irish immigrants and whatnot, who are trying to deal with the larger merchant class who were very conservative, very afraid of any kind of change and risk, who very very much looking at reconciliation. And that's very much in similar to what I find today, that we have a new generation that's emerging. It's quite exciting. That's trying to reframe many of the issues and discussions within the Democratic Party and the nation itself in terms of how we approach our economic politics and our immigration politics and the environment and whatnot. And we need that same kind of resolve, that same kind of backbone that Tom Paine helped manifest. Of course, when he published Common Sense on January 10, 1776, you know, he really galvanized us to push forward and go forward with what we've been talking about. You know, already there was this elite, this aristocracy that was kind of sort of for independence, but who wouldn't come forward? It was Paine who ultimately wrote this incredible publication that sparked this whole movement for the revolution to really take the final step. And of course, 6 months later, we had our Declaration of Independence. We tend to forget that it was Thomas Paine who first published the words United States of America, the person who really saw the future, you know, who said we have it in our power to recreate the world. And he wasn't talking about just replicating the English Constitution, the English system, but for the United States to come up with its own kind of future, its own kind of constitution that represented a nation of immigrants, a nation of indigenous people. And I think that's kind of the resolve and the kind of resistance that we need today. That's much of what I try to do in my book, is to look at not just Thomas Paine, but many people through the abolitionist movement, through the labor movement, through the immigrant rights movement, through the civil rights movement and the environmental protection movement, and especially women and people of color who have played this similar role time after time to help galvanize our spirit in such dark times. But I also go back to look at Paine and many other people in the past who see resistance as an agency of renewal. And I think in particular, for example, last week we had the president once again doing a very devastating decision, announcing the EPA's proposal to roll back the Clean Power Plan, which of course was an 11th hour plan by the Obama administration to put some kind of cap on carbon emissions from power plants. And I think if we look at resistance as more of an agency of renewal, recognizing that 70% of our carbon footprint is coming from cities anyway, it's not something that we nearly need to protest against Trump and protest against these kind of policies and these rollbacks, including more than 70 EPA rules right now that have affected us in terms of the environmental protection. But we need to see the cities and the states, such as California, take a lead role in actually doing climate action, actually moving toward having carbon-neutral cities, like you're seeing now in other parts of the world, moving toward regenerative cities, moving toward places in which we can actually affect change on the ground, be it the environmental civil rights or immigrant rights and sanctuary cities, but effectively through a local or statewide decision. And I feel like that as well is as important resistance to Trump as it is getting into the streets and trying to elect Democrats.
Well, I recently spoke with the country's leading authority on bringing power to major cities. He was head of the TVA, the LA Department of Water and Power, New York Power, the energy czar in California, who saved us from the predations of Enron, Dave Freeman. And in terms of the resistance, or those that are trying to bring about or at least address the urgency of climate change, he made the point, which I think is important for the resistance to get their act together, in the sense that quite often the battle cry, and Thomas Paine certainly knew how to frame things in a pithy way, in a way, net neutrality, of course, is a terrible term, doesn't tell you anything. Being pro-choice as opposed to pro-life is also not a very good rallying cry. But Dave was saying, we've got to stop using the term climate change, because the climate does change all the time, and use the word climate damage. What do you think of that as a tool of the resistance?
I think that works, but as part of, for example, my work with the Climate Narrative Project, I work with campuses and communities across the country to use the narrative arts to help reframe the whole climate change issue. I think even, you know, looking at solutions-based ideas is also another way of just dealing with it, not even dealing with the devastation, which we're all quite familiar with, but dealing also with some of the solutions. I mean, I've worked a lot with communities. For example, recently I've been working with Gary, Indiana, which is really one of the most devastated urban centers in the country, a place that's completely been depopulated and soaked with contamination of some of the largest steel mills and coal fire plants in the country. And there we've launched this incredible initiative to create what we call a regenerative city, a city that actually begins to produce both the energy and the food and the resources that they consume in a circular economy in a circular fashion, as opposed to being part of this linear economy and this linear system that essentially has to import everything, you know, both from importing our electricity to importing our food to importing all of our resources that then, you know, turn out to be have an incredibly high carbon expense. And so I think by reframing things in that way as well, both looking at solution-based issues as well as how we can begin the process of not just doing less bad, but actually enhancing our environment and beginning to repair some of the damage is some of the ways we have to go about this. You know, Ian, I talk a lot about Australia, believe it or not, these days. I talk a lot about the city of Adelaide, Australia, which 10 years ago faced a similar situation. And I'll put it in very few words. You had a city here that was completely dependent on coal fire plants, that imported 90% of its food, that found out that it really was reaching a major decision about water and whatnot and air quality. They came together. They met for 90 days. They brought in an incredible thinker named Herbert Girardet from England, who began to get them to think more in a circular fashion, a regenerative fashion. And now Adelaide, you know, 10 years later, has reduced their carbon footprint by nearly 30%, while their economy has also grown by 25%. They've planted 3 million trees. They've created the first solar district, the first solar bus in the world. They've aligned their cities in circles with more than 50,000 acres of local food, which then is brought into the center in these food markets. They've completely refashioned and reframed what the city is all about, and really is one of the leaders now in the city movement in terms of you know, working toward being a carbon neutral city. And that's the kind of thing I think we need to begin to replicate as well in the states in many different areas. And this, to me, is part of the discussion that resistance that we're often leaving out. Mm-hmm. That as we begin to take on or continue to take on Trump in many different arenas, both in the streets, in the courts in terms of immigrant rights, and in the electoral politics with our midterm elections coming up, we also need to begin to walk the walk in terms of actually doing actions locally in our cities. And I think that really ultimately might be the biggest contribution of resistance today.
Resistance becomes regeneration. I thank you very much for joining us, Jeff Biggers.
Thanks so much for having me, Ian.
And again, I've been speaking with Jeff Biggers, who's an award-winning historian, journalist, and playwright. He's the author of several books, including The United States of Appalachia, State Out of the Union, and Reckoning at Eagle Creek, and The Trials of a Scold. The founder of the Climate Narrative Project, his latest book is Resistance, Reclaiming an American Tradition. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at backgroundbriefing.org. We can also contact me, and I'll be back again with a special Labor Day program. Bye for now.